You know, a lot of people say that college is the time when young men and women expand the way that they look at their world, when they open their minds to new ideas and experiences, and when they begin that long journey from the innocence of youth to the responsibilities of adulthood. Now, isn't that a load of horseshit?
What?
Could you explain that to us a little more?
Dean Lewis, why don't you tell them a little bit about the philosophy here at South Harmon?
Look, we throw a lot of fancy words in front of these kids in order to attract them to going to school in the belief that they're going to have a better life. And we all know that all we're doing is breeding a whole new generation of buyers and sellers. Buyers and sellers. Pimps and whores. Pimps and whores. And indoctrinating them into a lifelong hell of debt and indecision.
I just don't understand.
Do I have to spoon feed it to you? Look, there's only one reason the kids want to go to school.
Holy shit.
Which is?
To get a good job. To get a good job with a great starting salary.
I couldn't agree more.
It's so refreshing to have somebody approach education so rationally.
Fucking A.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Today, Daryl and I will discuss the book Discipline Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives. It's written by a physicist named Jeff Schmidt, and the subtitle, I think, provides quite a bit of information about the message of that book. And while the purpose of today's show is to raise questions and encourage skepticism, if I may be so bold, about the current scientific community operating inside academia and or at taxpayer expense, I am at no point trying to make the argument that individual scientists or even large-scale scientific research projects are automatically inaccurate, unscientific, or perfidious because of where funding comes from, because of where the research takes place, or because of the obedient ideological containers in which the researchers work. But those additional factors are worth examining, namely the culture of certain academic institutions and the psychology of students, professors, and professionals doing the research. Again, I want to thank everybody who's participated in this series so far with comments and questions, and I hope today's discussion offers some new insights into the conflict between scientific consensus and dissent. But first, since this does come up in our discussion today, let's set the mood with a few selections from the ultimate history lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto. Here we go.
Is the school system designed to get kids to grow into a thriving, self-responsible, self-reliant adult? Or is it to whittle away curiosity and to kind of stop them from thinking for themselves?
It's certainly not the former in any way, for the simple reason that throughout history, management doesn't know how to manage independent units, even partially independent units. Why shouldn't we ask, and any school people watching your film should begin immediately to ask politely, why are we doing this? It's a question you never hear because it's heresy. I mean, the beleaguered classroom teacher doesn't know why he or she's doing that. They're told to do it. Maybe they can give a 5% personal spin. That's why they're doing it. Does it make sense for this particular life that's asking you the question? You don't know, and if you started to care, the logic of schooling would dissolve. I copied some notes out of the Ruth Bernstein book. He said that intensive and narrow scientific training will guarantee that you never make a scientific breakthrough. You know, you can get the best Johns Hopkins, it doesn't matter. It's the narrowness of training. The people who make these breakthroughs have as wide a range of mental and physical tools as possible. They almost invariably play musical instruments, are good at languages, etc., etc. Most successful people in physics make it by going off by themselves and learning whatever they want to, not following the history of the physical sciences. What they learn from mentors is how to deal with ambiguity. But the established bodies of scientific knowledge get in the way of thinking afresh. You know, as soon as you hear these things, they're so commonsensical, you say, of course, why didn't I think of that? Just a couple more here. Virtually every scientific pioneer, men like Edison, Franklin, Einstein, Planck, Maxwell, many others, had early opportunities to do absolutely independent research. All of them were in their early 20s, which has given rise to an understanding in the higher levels of the sciences that if you haven't made a major breakthrough by your middle 20s, you're not going to. What you can do is head up a project and be a bureaucrat and take credit, as many college professors do, for the discoveries of your students, but you're not going to be worth gambling on. It isn't the age in itself that limits insight. It's the imprint of rigid patterns of habits. One of the insights of discovering that really electrified me as I was reading it is how frequently the great discovery in a scientific arena is not made by the specialists in that area, by somebody from another area completely divorced who transfers into chemistry or physics, has fresh eyes, cuts through the habits that lock the mind in place, and makes the discovery. Says, freedom and flexibility is much more valuable than planning. Insight comes only by getting out of ruts and plugging into a variety of methods. So these great truths, it isn't that we're discovering them now. We're taking them out of their burial places and saying, hey, look, wake up. The world is much bigger and much different than you believe it is because you've been conditioned to believe it's that way.
I wanted to just read a little blurb from Wikipedia, and then I wanted to get your thoughts, just a brief synopsis of why the book is important to you. Disciplined Minds is a book by physicist Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. The book describes how professionals are made, the methods of professional and graduate schools, that turn eager entering students into disciplined managerial and intellectual workers that correctly perceive and apply the employer's doctrine and outlook. Schmidt uses examples of law, medicine, and physics and describes methods that students and professional workers can use to preserve their personalities and independent thought. So how did you first come across this book, and more importantly, how did it resonate with you, especially considering your experience that we've already talked about?
When I lived in Vermont, I was exposed to WGDR in Plainfield, Vermont, and what they were playing was a show coming out of Syracuse, New York, called Unwelcome Guests. And you could find this at unwelcomeguests.net. There was certainly a wide spectrum of discussions going on. Lynn Gary, the proprietor of that website and show at the time, she was someone who would be writing some pretty interesting, thought-provoking essays for the left-leaning Daryl Becker mind of the time. And periodically, I would hear her reading from a book. And one of the books was this one, Disciplined Minds, which periodically I would, you know, catch up on. I think there's not too many episodes where she pretty much goes right through the book in about, I think, something like 15 episodes, one for each chapter.
It's not a short book, yeah.
And I have to say that this was a prelude, because it was after reading this book that she came upon and then delivered in audiobook form The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto.
Yeah.
And that book, of course, was really mind-opening. It was much more so for me, because it started opening my mind to what exactly had happened to me. And Disciplined Minds, I saw that this is very relevant, because there are many people who are not in a salaried profession, or I'm not sure how, but they maybe survived professional training, and the mind washing process really worked on them. Somehow they thought that they were critical thinkers. Somehow they thought that the government was there to help them, and that there were systems of coercion were necessary to promote peace and harmony in this world, that people have to be forced because you cannot be trusting the average person. And this was, luckily, in the people that are in my personal life, that's a minority opinion. The people in my professional life, people who went through the same training that I went through, it was too frequent that I found there was an uncritical acknowledgement of what they went through, what other professionals go through, and how this affects critical thinking. In fact, what is a definition of critical thinking was often absent in my colleagues of this profession.
Yeah, I just want to jump in there for a second. I'm really glad you mentioned Unwelcome Guests, because people can go there, like you mentioned, and get the free audiobook of Underground History. But that being said, I think that a book like Disciplined Minds would be far more shocking and maybe a more uncomfortable experience for somebody who had never read an underground history of American education or was unfamiliar totally with the ideas that Gatto presents in that book and elsewhere. But I think there's also, myself included in this group not too long ago, people who have read Gatto's work and come across the message of Disciplined Minds and say, I can't believe I've never thought about this more closely. What happens to the mind of a scientist through this advanced schooling process? It's in many ways, in my opinion, naive to think that it would be dramatically different than what the rest of the schooling process is like. And it produces, again, this relates to our purposes here, obedient, uncreative, uncritical, well, disciplined minds that are good for the system that already exists. And I think this is a very important thing to enter into the record of our conversation about scientific consensus, a misnomer, as we've already pointed out, versus scientific dissent. If people are thinking more about the minds of mainstream scientists, maybe dissent becomes more viable and seemingly healthy a process when we contrast it to the people that Schmidt describes in this book.
Right. And I think both you and I know professionals
who went through types of training processes, maybe small ones or large ones, such as going to see what gaining a actual medical doctorate degree entails. We know professionals who went through that process, and we're seeing what happens with sleep deprivation, with the actual crushing of dreams, where they go in wishing to help people and they find out that it's more about dispensing pharmaceutical companies' preferred products. You go through the process of, say, want to help the children, and you find out that it's about separating children from their parents and putting them into life-threatening and sometimes deadly situations.
Yep.
You know, that's another profession, the Child Protective Services. So we all know professionals out there who, as they climbed the mountain of knowledge, which we discussed in the previous show, we know professionals who went through, and as they climbed the mountain of knowledge and information and understanding and seeing the practical applications, what they find out is that from the ground floor, when they looked up and they said, I'm going to climb that mountain, I'm going to become that professional, then they get up there and they find out, it's not about that. No, that was the front story. That was the little propaganda. That's the Donald Duck story of pay your taxes.
Yeah.
You know, this, in reality, there was a whole other story, and this was what it's really about. These are the people who it really serves. And that is the point of why I brought this book to your attention. I just saw that, hey, there's a lot of people out there, before we even start to talk about some of the dissenting scientific opinions, I think it would be very critical to look at what is a scientific professional and what is their training composed of.
And that being said, I wanted to share with the audience a little clip from the book under the heading Ideology and Professionals. It's right at the beginning. For understanding the professional, the concept of ideology will emerge as much more useful than that of skill. But what is ideology exactly? Ideology is thought that justifies action, including routine day-to-day activity. It is your ideology that determines your gut reaction to something done, say, by the president. You feel it is right or wrong. By protesters, you feel it is justified or unjustified. By your boss, you feel it is fair or unfair. By a coworker, you feel it is reasonable or unreasonable, and so on. More importantly, your ideology justifies your own actions to yourself. Economics may bring you back to your employer day after day, but it is ideology that makes that activity feel like a reasonable or unreasonable way to spend your life. Work in general is becoming more and more ideological, and so is the workforce that does it. As technology has made production easier, employment has shifted from factories to offices, where work revolves around inherently ideological activities, such as design, analysis, writing, accounting, marketing, and other creative tasks. Of course, ideology has been a workplace issue all along. Employers have always scrutinized the attitudes and values of the people they hire to protect themselves from unionists, radicals, and others whose bad attitude would undermine workplace discipline. Today, however, for a relatively small but rapidly growing faction of jobs, employers will carefully assess your attitude for an additional reason: its crucial role in the work itself. On these jobs, which are in every field from journalism and architecture to education and commercial art, your view of the world threatens to affect not only the quantity and quality of what you produce, but also the very nature of the product. These jobs require strict adherence to an assigned point of view, and so a prerequisite for employment is the willingness and ability to exercise what I call ideological discipline. This is a book about people who get these jobs and become members of the ideological workforce, that is, professionals. One more quick paragraph. My thesis is that the criteria by which individuals are deemed qualified or unqualified to become professionals involve not just technical knowledge, as is generally assumed, but also attitude. In particular, attitude toward working within an assigned political and ideological framework. I contend, for example, that all tests of technical knowledge, such as the graduate record examinations, the GRE, and the law school admission test, the LSAT, are at the same time tests of attitude, and that the examinations used to assess professional qualification are no exception. I consider in detail how neutral-looking technical questions on such examinations probe the candidate's attitude. The qualifying attitude, I find, is an uncritical, subordinate one, which allows professionals to take their ideological lead from their employers and appropriately fine-tune the outlook that they bring to their work. The resulting professional is an obedient thinker, an intellectual property whom employers can trust to experiment, theorize, innovate, and create safely within the confines of an assigned ideology. The political and intellectual timidity of today's most highly educated employees is no accident. Now that, I mean, when I read that, that totally made me rethink this whole scientific debate that we've introduced here. And of course, as I read further into the book, it reinforced that rethinking.
Exactly. I think there was that sentence I really wanted to underline, within the confines of, can you say that one?
Yeah, within the confines of an assigned ideology.
Thank you. That is critical, because we still have people out there who think, well, obviously they're an expert, and obviously all these experts are independently checking themselves to make sure that they are working within what you would call reality, which hopefully keeps changing and shifting based upon evidence, not upon a designated reality that is, essentially like a false reality that is put upon by their employers.
Yeah, and it seems like this all relates to something that we talked about in an earlier show, which we referred to as adjustment, right? This is a process of adjustment.
Right.
So there were some great examples in the book. Police obviously need to be adjusted. Psychiatry is an adjusted profession where at no point is anyone tasked with questioning the environment or the society. You're only tasked with questioning the individual subject of the psychiatric treatment. Lawyers, he describes, as being almost entirely ideology. In the book, it says they don't go to law school to learn the law. They go to the law school to learn to be lawyers. And the technical knowledge is kind of an afterthought. So whether it's, you know, pretty low technical training like the police, even though there's some involved, to more advanced forms of technical training, psychiatry and law, the technical portion of it is not the priority.
I wanted to add that the mechanisms to produce this type of lack of critical thinking are amazing. And I think that every one of the audience to your show, I think almost every one of them, including students who are presently enrolled in a government school, would understand this first one, alienating work. This is mentioned in several of the chapters where there is a bunch of make work, this mindless, useless production of answers to questions that have small or no relevance to getting any practical situation completed. The alienating work is something I'm very familiar with because first I went through it as a student when I went through Oriental Medical College once and second time, and then I became a professor, and then I was dishing out alienating work, and all I could do was soften the alienating work. All I could do was to try to say, okay, this alienating work that I'm handing out is for one of the four purposes. One would be strictly to help you in, you know, showing, demonstrating that you can pass this class should another teacher who didn't want to instantly give people A's want, you know, to take over this class. Two, it would be to help with subsequent classes. It's all academic and eventually the board exam. It could be, you know, a third thing where it's just strictly for clinical, and that would be, sorry, alienating work is not clinically or practically significant. It could be for purpose four, which was, you know, maybe giving you some memorization tactics to remember things to communicate with other Oriental medical practitioners, people in the profession. Or number five, it could be information that you're using just for the purpose of communicating to other medical professionals or other professionals at all. Basically, just gaining skill with memorizing nomenclature or jargon words.
So where did you feel a majority of the work assigned landed?
Oh, I felt it was strictly and just useless clinically and like mostly in the purposes of memorization of pleasing people in the profession or being able to communicate to people in the profession, including clinical supervisors. When you go through Oriental Medical College, you do some 900 plus hours of supervised clinical work in the student clinic. You are working as an acupuncturist, but you are covered by a licensed acupuncturist's license. So they have a vested interest in you producing good results and nothing endangering their license, which could happen. Mm-hmm. And that means that what you're doing is you're going in, you're being given maybe 5 or 10 minutes and sometimes even less depending on the schedule to quickly get all of your diagnostic data and quickly make an assessment and deliver to your supervisor a diagnosis and a treatment plan based upon the diagnosis. And all these things you learn how to do, although certainly that was the process that I learned, some people would struggle with that process because treating people is an art. And you don't need to be, you know, technically speaking, this is totally superfluous. You can give a great treatment. I could teach anyone listening to this how to give a great treatment without the memorization of that process. But what I was teaching was how to please a clinical supervisor to give them a mostly appropriate diagnosis based upon the information that you're collecting. And a very appropriate treatment plan based upon that diagnosis. I showed them how to please supervisors, basically. And that will never happen in real life because as a real life acupuncturist, you don't have a supervisor. You have clients. You either get results with them or you do not. It's about that simple. You know, I mean, you could get so-so results too. There's a, you know, gray area between those two, but that's what I was learning as I was dishing out work to say, okay, this is strictly to pass the board exams, the memorization of what we call in the business the big picture. It's all of these categories of points and the memorization of point location, these you know, mnemonics and various things where we memorize the various acupuncture channels in various ways. It's phenomenal. It's amazing. And of course, it's promptly forgotten once you go into practice. You know, you only use maybe some 30 to 70 different points most of the time, and then maybe you might occasionally look other ones up.
Interesting.
It's fascinating. I mean, like, there's more than 400 established points there. Most people never use them all in actual clinical practice. You tend to get into some type of routine. Sometimes you expand it as you get a bit more artistic because you, of course, are seeking results. And the only good thing about the process is that the clinical training allows you to actually see measurement before and during and after and seeing results. And that boosts confidence in the student. And so most of the time, I was definitely always delineating when I was a professor, where is this assignment going? Is it just for the purpose of helping them through their board exams, or is it helping them in any of the other purposes which I outlined?
And because you've had all this experience, what do you feel, and you can just focus on your own discipline, what do you feel real valuable educational work would look like for somebody like that?
It would look like precisely what I started with, which was an apprenticeship program.
Yeah.
You go in, you work with the professional, and you're measuring before and during and after, and you're seeking results. That's what the clients are paying for. I use the word clients. Some people like the word patients. It's fine. They're synonyms to me. I think that I like clients better than patients, as a, even though, you know, technically speaking, I could call them patients if I wanted to. But it all comes down to the practical applications. It comes down to what is applicable in any situation. And there's so many causal vectors that in this reality, as far as I can tell, it's immeasurable. You will never measure all the causal vectors for the health situations of your clients or your patients. whoever it is that you work for, you cannot measure everything that's causing and affecting things. What you can measure are certain things that are measurable. You could just do that. So an educational process is the same as becoming a contractor carpenter, is the same as becoming a journeyman of any trade. You go and you apprentice. The actual aspects of schooling and examinations, which we're going to touch on in a moment, are utterly superfluous, because an examination never, ever touches on anything other than the fact that it is showing how clever and obedient is this person to follow orders.
All right. So a couple of notes. It sounds like from what you're describing in medicine, and this would probably be true in psychiatry as well, because of the way things work, you're not treating patients or clients. You're treating conditions because that's easier. You don't have to deal with all of these causal vectors. So it's, again, it's adjustment for them too, right? It's adjusting them to a pre-existing condition that you have in mind, instead of, like, an example from my personal life. I've had one doctor ask me about my diet. One ever. I don't feel like that's enough. So
right.
They're focused on conditions. And the other part of it, so I think you touched on that, and I think that's really important. The other thing, as far as the training is concerned, this institutional training versus apprenticeship, obviously in institutional training, you're going to have people pumped out who are far more machine-like, because they have to be in that environment as a collective, versus an apprenticeship where you're most likely one-on-one with somebody. And just like you're treating a client and not a condition, you're training a person and not a discipline, or you're teaching a person and not a subject.
Precisely. And here comes the rub, basically. You can have, from the bottom of the mountain of information of your profession, an idea that to get excellent training in your profession, you're going to seek a certain type of educational institution. You're going to be thinking, if you're indoctrinated from government schools, you're going to be thinking that you're looking for a certain type of institution. Now, luckily, I was disabused of this long ago when I started my training back when I was 26 and I began being an apprentice back when I began Oriental Medical College in 1998. I was only going into the college that was nearest to me because I had a little daughter, you know, who was at that time, it's like about 3 years old, you know.
Yeah.
So I did not want to move away to a different state. I couldn't fathom how to do that even. You know, I loved living in Vermont at that time. And I couldn't imagine, you know, that I would make it work. So my professional who I was apprenticing with at the time found me a school not too far away, like an hour and a half drive away. And that school was rural. So that was the first aspect. It was small and rural. The second aspect was, as it was composed of professionals who were first in line, meaning like they were acquired their license as the first part of the beginning of that profession, acquiring licensure status and close to doctor status. So they some of them had been grandfathered in through their trainings. A bunch of them had gone to China and learned more of an old school methodology, although there's a different subject on that. They had more of a vested interest in helping students become practitioners than helping students become professional test takers. So I went through something that was like that. And then when I came to look for a school that actually had accreditation, mm-hmm. when I looked for a school that had the papers necessary for me to get my license, I sought a similar type of school, small and rural, where I would be looking at small size classes and I would be looking at that type of personal touch of the teachers who had a vested interest in us being excellent practitioners, but not necessarily being indoctrinated to one or other type of ideology. So I luckily like escaped that type of thing. Now, I do know people who went to the big schools, talking 100 plus students, and lecture hall type classes and going through all of the rigmarole that a medical degree student would go through, including autopsies, living in a city, you know, all the things like that. They went through a more traumatic format than I did. And I got to teach alongside those when I was a professor too. I got to see what happened to them. And by and large, most of them seemed to me to buy the idea that examinations and doing well on tests and things of that nature and being like a standard student was very important, at least to show the world that we were a good college, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we only passed like, you know, like normal good type students and not these anomalies, you know? I saw that there was a problem in that, but the stresses of upon all of us as professors and the stress that pretty much I would say was part of the demise of that college, there was no real room to, you know, open up that door. It was like on my list, you know, of like goals, like to say, hey, let me open that door later on after I save the school from demise, which I could not do.
Right. So let me ask you this. I said recently in an interview, I don't remember what show I was on, that if people are serious about going to college or having their kids go to college in this day and age, the only thing that I can see that really makes sense as far as non-super specialized professions, like outside of medical, outside of engineering, outside of law, which all require college degrees anyway, so you'd have to go to college no matter what. But if you just see college as a necessary step forward in your life, the only thing that really makes sense is to go to one of the best schools with a large endowment. I went to a small school that was not really adapting to changes in the world. Now, the class sizes were great. I mean, sometimes it was 5-on-1. Sometimes it was, you know, 12-to-15-on-1. But unfortunately, I didn't get much of an education there because they were stuck in a previous age technologically. And I wasn't even in a super specialized discipline. I mean, I majored in communications. So how about that? I mean, do you think that smaller schools with less money coming in from alumni, for some people, that could be a liability to avoid?
It is a huge issue. Again, same thing like with getting things done, the GTD method. What is your objective? If your objective is to go through relatively unscathed and somehow collect your permission slip or your licensure or whatever it is that's the purpose of going through that educational process in the first place, well, you're looking for all of the features that you want. If you wish for smaller class sizes, that's okay. But in general, smaller schools are unstable, and there's always the possibility that the school could go under, requiring you to move again. Okay?
Yeah.
That could just happen. So you just understand that. Like, certainly in Oriental medical colleges, I think it's down to, what, 43 of them left or so in the United States alone. And it will keep shrinking likely because there's an attack on professional training institutions. They if they don't have 100-plus students and huge endowments, they are on shaky ground unless they have some specialization process where they can really rake it in. So although you have a pros and cons list as a professional, you go in and you want a nice gentle hand, you can get that in the small schools. Will you get the whole piece of paper at the end of it? That's in question. You will get that in a big institution, but yeah. Will you survive living in a city? Will your relationship survive going through this process? Will you actually get much benefit from that type of training? And you can, of course, go through the motions, as it describes in this book, where in Disciplined Minds, the author describes putting on a show of a certain attitude, which was required to demonstrate in order to get that degree in physics, you know, to demonstrate that you were going to definitely toe the line. Now, you can go through that process. You can also, you know, just understand what is the purpose, what is your objective, and to really do a cost-benefit analysis of what type of training are you seeking. There has been a concerted destruction and attack against the apprenticeship program in professional training for a reason. And that reason is to produce reliable, according to the authorities, experts who are called upon to deliver the word of science or God, essentially the modern God. And this is the process of indoctrination, which this book very much exposes.
So, Daryl, we do ultimately want to get to the end of this book, which is resistance, how Schmidt essentially suggests that people should resist this kind of indoctrination. But I wanted to pull some excerpts from earlier in the book to just elucidate the problem a little bit better. So chapter 4 is called Assignable Curiosity. And I want to relate to what we've already discussed, but I also want to start dispelling this idea that scientific research is necessarily objective. Schmidt writes, "Do university scientists freely set the courses of their own careers? Or do outside forces lead them to enter particular subfields within their disciplines, to take up particular topics within those subfields? To ask the same question in a different way, how much freedom do those who fund scientific research give those who do scientific research? The federal government sponsors the bulk of the basic scientific research that goes on in U.S. universities. Most basic physics research at universities, for example, is sponsored by just 4 government agencies: the Department of Energy, successor to the Atomic Energy Commission, the National Science Foundation, the Department of Defense, of course, through the Army Research Office, the Office of Naval Research, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, and so on, and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA. 99% of the federal funding for basic physics research at universities comes through these 4 agencies. In 1995, the federal government spent about $590 million on university physics research. About $455 million of that expenditure paid for research characterized as basic. At the University of California, Irvine, my old school, physics professors in 1996 got $8.7 million of their $10.2 million in R&D money from the federal government. To what extent do university pipers themselves call the tune when the government pays for their work? The government, like any sponsor, is keenly aware of its influence and has known the answer to this question since the 1950s, when it began to dominate the funding of basic research in universities in the United States. So we see this whole thing with all these problems existing in this very, very important container. And even people who might put down scientific dissent or this idea that there's this uniformity in obedience within the scientific community, especially in research universities, I think they know this. But the extent to which the system, as he repeatedly says in the book, dominates the work that can be done in sciences, the conclusions that can be reached in science, that's a pretty considerable factor in all of this, isn't it?
It's so considerable that you find more open-mindedness in the hobbyists and the multidisciplinarians who have nothing to lose and everything to gain by their own private investigations of these topics. You find more open-mindedness in those venues than ever will you find in any university or any of these government-funded scientific studies. And that is something right there just to consider. You're looking to say, I'm not into the government. I don't like that. I wish for more freedom and more autonomy and less tyranny. And if you're at the same time seeking verification of certain so-called scientific facts, unquote, from such sources, which are completely in a very limited hangout, as you just described, you're not going to really, you know, you're trusting an authority for your body, just in medicine, just to start with, okay? Because you imagine that it's too complicated for you to learn about how to care for your own body, and therefore it requires all of these years of medical school and the indoctrinating processes that they go through, rather than just learning it on yourself. Yet somehow you could figure out how to use a circular saw, a very dangerous item, I might add, and other power tools, and build things in your backyard, and perhaps even learn to use automotive tools to repair your car. But at the same, you know, you cannot learn how to help with your own body and the body of your loved ones. Now, that is an interesting little thing right there. You have certain things where it's the realm of a salaried professional who went through all of these years of schooling and understanding mitochondria and the Krebs cycle and various items like that.
Right.
And, you know, I know that over there in New Hampshire, Brett Vinat does not need to understand the Krebs cycle to be able to isolate the effects of the supplements that he uses. Neither
I've
do I.
I've made it this far without even knowing what that is.
Exactly. And so that's the same type of thing. It's just these assumptions which are quickly made. Going back to the idea of one of the worst things that I ever did to my students as a professor, I gave them exams.
Mm-hmm.
I hope it's okay to launch into that right now. But,
oh, yeah. Please do. Yeah.
Yeah, I gave them exams, and every single time I would give them an advance notice of here's when the quiz is happening, here's when the exam is happening, and I would tell them, I'm sorry, I'm required to do this, and here's why I'm sorry. This has only function one. This is strictly academic and will have little or no clinical significance and will demonstrate how clever you are in memorization, in utilizing the mnemonics, which I showed you to help pass this and other subsequent classes. I just really I'm sorry, but this is my first year as a professor. I'm not, you know, going to buck this game quite yet. I'm not ready to, but I want to in the future. And here's the exam that I'm pumping out for you.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things right there. Now, in the book, Disciplined Minds, Schmidt goes on to describe the purposes that this can be utilized for figures in authority who have designed educational systems this way. And one of the ones that I noted was the process of cooling out. This is really well described in the book. He describes a three-card Monty game where you have individuals who are all in league, essentially, with the three-card Monty player. They find a mark. The people who are in league play with the player and seem to win. Then the mark is identified by the three-card Monty dealer, and suddenly he's encouraged by members of the audience who happen to have been planted in there to go ahead and play. And when he loses, he's also encouraged that it's okay because it was all just a game of chance and, you know, you lost fair and square. He's encouraged that to essentially cool out, an old expression that's not used much more. In academia, there's a similar form of cooling out, and it's used by those who dish out tests and think that this is a good thing. In other words, if you don't do well on tests, but you might have extremely proficient clinical skills, well, I guess you're just not cutting out to make a good professional. And that's one of the purposes of exams, is to demonstrate how obedient and simplistic is your mind. Can you just simply memorize and spit things back out?
Yeah, and if there's protest or failure along the way, you have a way of streamlining who's going to make it towards the end. Right. And there's an incredible amount of obedience and tolerance for this kind of stuff that he points out in the book. He said like over 90% of people who enter medical school finish. Like, and that was 15 years ago. The numbers could be very different today. The book was written in 2000. That's insane to me. I would have thought it was like 20%. And there are some scientific disciplines like engineering that are below 50, but that shows a very obedient, conformist mindset.
Precisely. And I remember seeing one type of study where they asked beginning med students how important did they think nutrition and diet was in the health of their future patients. And there was a huge percentage of them said that it's very important. And then they asked the same question to those graduating, and they said it was not really that important.
Wow.
So it shows that there was a serious aspect of indoctrination going on. And we have heard the stories of the process of interning as a medical doctor, where they're pretty much put through sleep deprivation,
yes,
working absurd shifts and, you know, like, you know, basically breaking their minds down. you know, given humiliating jobs that are way below, you know, certain of their skill sets, and yet at the same time, you know, seeing the tenured doctor above them giving them these orders for them, the person who's already been through these things. I think I mentioned sour grapes in the previous episode.
Yeah.
Because I went through it, now you have to as well. And I did experience that as a professor. I saw other professors dishing out situations where it was just challenging for no apparent reason other than the fact that they had to do it too, and that it was on the syllabus. It's part of the curriculum. It's just what we have to do. There's no questioning. It all comes back to the same thing that I would mention every single time on pretty much every single podcast I ever do, is it comes down to critical thinking and the skill one has to balance the emotional terrain inside of oneself. What is that process? If you understand that process as something that you could explain in a couple sentences, like I use the trivium, I use voluntary communication, as I've outlined in the Trivium Applied to Communication series, I use these as quick as I can or in depth as much as I need to promote abundance in my life as best as I can, and to diminish scarcity as best as I can. But my fellow professors, many of them were indeed broken. They were, you know, shattered as a process. They really were excellent practitioners, but the only reason that they were teaching as professors was because they needed some extra income. And there is a desire to want to help these students through. This was a failing school and it needed professors. And that's why me and some others were called up and given a job. Not because we happen to be the best at indoctrinating, not because we happen to, you know, go along the path to say, I want to be a professional acupuncturist trainer.
Yeah.
No, that was not the reason, but it certainly was an aspect of understanding a goal. So many people will go through the motions of life or of their job, not knowing their objectives. Thus, the actions are pre-described by other people. Thus, the resources are squandered, you know, the resources you need to do the actions to get to the objectives.
Yeah. So far, we've covered the adjustment in training, which is not technical training, but attitude or ideological training, which you just said results in people essentially being damaged or broken. There's something else that he describes going on in the book. Towards the middle, there's a chapter called Dreams of Escape. And he says in this chapter that people who, this is not a quote, I'm paraphrasing, people who really deep down feel the most trapped are, in his opinion, the most likely to develop strong emotion-driven defenses to criticisms of the system or the profession or the status quo in a particular profession. So I thought that was interesting, but there's the trap emotionally that I just described, but there's also the trap of perspective, right? People are discouraged from looking at the big picture of a particular discipline because of this division of labor. And I wanted to just share another short passage from the book, two short paragraphs. No matter what the product is, employers divide the work into many parts and assign each employee to one type of activity. Narrowly focused individuals can work in a more machine-like way and get more work done per hour. Moreover, people who exercise fewer skills or simpler skills can be paid less. Hence, employers label the division of labor efficient. But it is efficient only if one ignores the social cost of organizing production in a way which jobs tend to be monotonous and unsatisfying. Such jobs, instead of allowing individuals to develop their mental and physical faculties by exercising them freely and fully, that is, instead of being fun, numb the mind and the body and retard the personal development of those employed to do them. A system of production that works efficiently toward the goals of employers does not necessarily work efficiently toward the goals of employees or toward the goals of society in general. More important to employers than the economic benefits, however, are the political benefits of the division of labor.
benefits that help management maintain its authority in the workplace. Confined to a range of activity that is limited both horizontally and vertically, employers do not gain firsthand knowledge of the overall organization, strategy, or goals of the institution that employs them. Those who work within this division of labor see the consequent ignorance in themselves and in their coworkers and feel a need to be directed by people who comprehend the whole operation. Management has the broadest view of what is going on, and this helps make its supreme authority in the workplace seem natural and justified.
And that's an aspect that I got to live. I got to see it multiple times. I definitely wanted to add that when we're looking at which type of institution of training you go through, you can see that there's a difference between professors who have recently just acquired their licensure and just recently gotten into the business. And I'm very, very fortunate that I've had some of those, as they have a great deal of sympathy for the process that we go through and just wish for good practitioners to come out of this process. And then there are those who are many, many years past that process. They remember it themselves differently because the more you go back, the more decades you go back, the easier the process is to enter that profession. Mm-hmm. Because just like the game of Limbo, the bar keeps going down and it keeps getting tougher each year, basically. So
yeah.
The professors who back in the day, you know, they don't even understand like how obscenely difficult it is. And many of them would never pass their licensure or board exam of that profession without intensive preparation and might not even pass at all, you know. And that's just an aspect of some of this indoctrination process.
That's interesting in Limbo, and I'm sure you have a lot of that out in Hawaii, how lowering the bar actually means getting more difficult. Usually it's raising the bar.
Yeah, it was a metaphor. I think we all know how tough it is to limbo under a really low bar. It's just impossible. So
just point of clarification. Yeah, so from now on, if somebody says raise the bar, I'll just say, hey, you're not talking about limboing, are you? Because you've got it backwards if you are.
Right. Maybe raise the bar would be for pole vault, you know. So, yeah, it is kind of like that, you know, like, you know, it was like a 4-foot pole vault for some of my first professors in the first college I went through back in 98. You know, I mean, literally they could sit and they had a written exam where they could change their answers. And, you know, there was certainly someone proctoring and trying to make sure that no one cheated. But at this, you know, it was simple, relatively speaking. I mean, it was still absurd. And their teachers, the teachers who gave them their skills, essentially, had nothing, had no test at all, and were simply grandfathered in by virtue of knowing their medicine. Some of them, they are textbook authors on the subject. Mm-hmm. And they go around doing the lecture circuit and, you know, going to the conferences, etc. So it really is like that, where, you know, you start off in the you know, where like literally for them, it was just like walking up to the pole, which is a foot off the ground, and stepping over it, you know, carrying your pole vault with it. You know, you don't really have to do much. And then for, you know, for myself, it was like a hurdle of going through this procedure of a palm imprint scan of like looking at the veins in my palm and like the photo of my face and fingerprints and like, you know, to enter into the thing and like, you know, scanning to see if I have electronic devices on me, you know, and, you know, going into this room where people are all in their little booths testing all types of different subjects. It's a professional testing facility. And each test that I took, and I only took two of them because that's all Hawaii needed, I went through the process. You get one chance to enter into a question in the computer. There's no going back. There's no changing your mind based upon things that you see, like my professors got to do when they went through their testing long ago. And then at the end of it, you get to, you know, push the final, are you sure? This is the final question. Are you sure you want to answer it that way? Mm-hmm. And you enter in yes. And then you wait like literally like part of a second. And thankfully for me, congratulations, you have passed. And the second time, it was so nerve-wracking for me that I literally gave the computer monitor a double middle finger, which is not very nonviolent communication of me. Literally, it was, you know, like all the process of staying up and going through all of that, and to know that I didn't have to pay another $400, $500, $600 to fly back to Oahu to go through that process again. That's what that thing there was. It was telling me that you've got it, Daryl. You've got your license in the next series of months when they deign to send it to you. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the one of the processes of breaking the individual, and it is that type of thing. When we go into solutions soon, I would say. I think what we're going to cover is just really, really explicitly having your critical thinking skills intact and knowing what your purposes are, so that wherever you choose to go for your licensure or your training, you really have that clear, and then you could make a survival guide for yourself that's based upon that.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's begin the third act by reviewing the first two here. I think we spent a fair amount of time talking about, as Schmidt does in the book, the model, or the mold, more appropriately, that professionals are supposed to fit into, this ideological caution that they're supposed to have, certainly by the end, but preferably at the beginning of school. And even if they don't, the second thing that we talked about that you discussed through test taking and the cooling out, right?
Yeah.
Is this idea of selection, winnowing down the pool to the most conformist and obedient, and dare I say, as far as what we consider critical thinking, maybe some of the more non-critical types of thinkers. But the third focus in the book, beyond the attributes of the modern professional and the selection process for professionals, is the resistance to all of this. And I would think that part of the book really resonated with you.
It did, although I did not write down a series of notes, which I kind of wish I had, but I think that's because now I realize that every individual is specific in what they need to survive whatever educational process that they are intending to go through. Mm-hmm. What they need is specific, just like in terms of the needs of my clients, is specific. There is no universal that I would proclaim, you all need to do this, you all need this. So the second to last chapter, How to Survive Professional Training, is relevant. And the author went through first some research looking into the Army Field Guide of Surviving POW Camps. The essentially the training, there's one version of the training that he was able to find. He actually was interviewing people in the military about this subject and asking for a bibliography of where they got their information for how to survive intact when you are captured by the enemy.
Yeah.
And that is a very powerfully written chapter, the second to last chapter in this book, going over a variety of the trauma things. And in the book, he says, you know, all you have to do is substitute POW camp for educational facility and captors for professors and administration. And, you know, certainly the prisoner is substituted for the student.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and death is substituted for expulsion, or essentially being forced out of the profession. And then you pretty much get the same exact type of thing where, you know, you are put under, you know, time constraints that are absurd, that the alienating work that's leveled on you is a similar type of thing, like digging a ditch and filling it back in. And that's kind of the summary of some of the make work of alienating work that it does, including the taking of pointless exams. There are certainly the other things of the unfortunate situation of substandard food being consumed, fast food, etc., by the professional, as they just are under such pressure that they succumb to the simplicity of to-go food and eating out of boxes.
Coffee?
Yeah, there's
cigarettes.
There's, of course, the self-medication processes that happen. You know, this is the what was starting off as like less problematic and more innocuous habits before the professional began their training, to dependencies that become considerably more destructive. There's the destruction between relationships in the prisoner of war camps where they try to do a divide and conquer thing, you know, to essentially set up bullies and here and there to try and promote disharmony amongst the prisoners.
Yeah.
And the same thing is done in a professional environment where they are encouraging competition, where they're making it understood who's got the high grades and who is following orders appropriately and who is struggling to maintain the grade point average that's required for that profession. And in my profession, I had a grade point average that was required. And that was an aspect of it. And other thing that he mentions, Schmidt mentions in Disciplined Minds, is the keeping of certain grades of the examinations that you take to be able to enter the institution and the one that you go through for your licensure, your board exams, etc., to keep those grades completely secret. And that's, to this day, I don't know what I got on my board exams, nor do any of my colleagues.
You just know that you passed.
All I know is I passed. I saw, congratulations, you have passed. And you don't know by what margin, you know, like how close was it, basically, as if that, well, all that really matters, of course, is like, you know, to what degree of information was I able to cram in and then spit back out like a baby bird, you know?
Right. Yeah.
That image is very appropriate because it literally was, you know, to some degree for some professions, it's like that where you're just the baby bird with your mouth open and there's the professor going blah, blah, blah into your mouth, you know? He goes through procedures of making unity with your other students.
Yes.
And a process of connecting with your values that you entered the profession originally with, to keep hold of those things. He does not go into what I would consider more critical, which is critical thinking skills, that is explicit methods of organizing and maintaining your intellectual terrain, and of course, empathetic and emotional skills to keep your emotional internal terrain somewhat steady, and so that whatever happens, you always are able to feel more at ease because you don't have a pressure coming from without. You're not angry at the institution or even a specific teacher. You're just looking at the situations. They come at you. You notice your feelings. You identify values that you're after that are causing those feelings. And then you make a strategy of action or actually take action to create the equilibrium that you desire. Without those skills, you're going to be a little lost, in my opinion. And that is what I would emphasize.
And that's a little bit further down the line. I think knowing is a good portion of the battle here. I would say there's probably a lot of professors in these institutions that don't even know what's going on as far as what Schmidt describes in the book. But to be the student and to know this is obviously a huge step in the right direction. The second thing being support, super, super important, as you mentioned. Just for the purposes of reinforcement, you're talking about the chapter Surviving Professional Training, and there's a heading here called Confrontation or Obliteration. When your identity is under attack, working with other resistors is key to keeping control over who you are. An institution cannot brainwash active opponents of its point of view as long as the opponent's organization is democratic and independent of the institution itself. Institutions find such individuals frustrating to quote-unquote educate because they have a strong independent sense of reality and a strong base of support. Students who try to go it alone, no matter how strong they appear to be, end up transformed and afraid to challenge those in power. The tactic of trying to trick the training institution by pretending to have adopted its values commonly backfires. Now, I would imagine that within these institutions, especially medical, there are students who are saying to each other, doesn't this suck? You know, like I would think that's pretty common. But they're probably also telling themselves something that I certainly told myself as a high school student. I thought college was fine, but I didn't go to a good school or get a meaningful degree. So I do have to say it wasn't a ton of work. But I remember feeling that kind of trapped feeling in high school and saying, doesn't it suck, to other people, but then kind of resigning myself to this idea that it couldn't be any other way. It's not like I could go apprentice. When I was 14, I didn't even know what that concept meant. Right. So I think there's a lot of people in this situation who, even though they might identify to each other some of the problems or some of the frustrations or difficulties that they feel, they don't feel like there's anything that they can do about it. And that's why I wanted to jump back, first identify, then, you know, find some support, and then develop a method to deal with it. That's where you can go from recognizing that there's a problem and connecting with other people who know there's a problem. You can develop a solution, first of all, to defend yourself and to think through it and maintain your curiosity, your individuality, and of course, your critical thinking in the process.
Right. And it's very important to recognize that people who are entering a professional educational institution have already been through other types of breaking of their critical thinking skills,
yes,
and other types,
yeah,
of breaking of their emotional terrain balancing skills. They've already been through that. So now they're going through it yet again. And this is the problem, is the unfortunate assumption that due to cleverness of being able to regurgitate information, there is a person who has critical thinking. That's not at all so, of course, as we've covered many times. But it might be possible to quickly reestablish critical thinking skills with some small study. It's also possible to establish emotional equilibrium gaining skills with some small practice and study. It just comes down to that one thing of identifying what is the main issue that's needed. And when it comes down to it, the process of what is it called? Sleep deprivation of people who really want their medical doctorate degree.
Yeah.
They're going through that process. You are now resigned to going through sleep deprivation as an intern. That's just down the road. As someone who didn't do that, I'm not the most qualified person to tell you how to best get through that. All I could say is that, yes, you want to maintain your spirit and your health first, you and your the biggest sphere of influence, that's yourself. And then the next sphere of influence out, those that you love and you have close contact with, your significant other, your friends and family, you as best as possible, as much as you think is helpful to your life. You want to maintain that and make it thrive more than maintain, but you want it like a garden where it's pumping out produce.
Mm.
And if you're not achieving those things, well, at least understand that those are goals and that there are other people out there that you could seek as resources to achieve certain identified actions to get to that objective, just to understand that that is an objective right there, to maintain some type of unscathed exit from that process so that you can be a professional. Then, you know, you go further to see what are the other obstacles that happen in the midst of the educational process. I am very fortunate that luckily the profession I went through was not at all as traumatizing as the one of becoming an MD or medical doctor. It's not as all traumatizing as becoming a juris doctorate or lawyer. It's just less than that, thank God. You know, like if it had been like that, that's one of the reasons why I did not choose those professions. And I certainly have had people say, oh, Daryl, would you like to go through medical school to get a real medical degree?
Yeah.
You know, and I've, you know, yeah. And you laugh at that because you know that the jokers that you've gone to who have real medical degrees didn't seem to be able to give you, I would say, a service that you'd want to pay for. In fact, they dished out a service that you were glad was covered by your insurance policy, because you'd really probably want to give them the finger rather than pay for what they dished out to you.
Mm.
So that's understandable, you know, and I don't advise people giving people the finger, by the way. I'm just, you know, understanding that like this is frustrating, and that's my bit of New York coming out there.
Yeah,
I
absolutely.
Grew up in New York. So, you know, it's that type of thing where just to understand what is the purpose that your objective. If you're trying to get through something, you can pick a good location of the educational institution. So at the very least, on your off time, you have the possibility of recuperating, of feeling good about yourself because you live in fill in the blank. Like I chose Hawaii for one of those reasons. If I was going to have to go through this traumatic process again, it better be in a nice place, you know?
Right, yeah.
So that's one reason I chose Hawaii, you know? Relationship did not hold together through the process, but that's okay because that was meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I did certainly understand that. I got to see that for myself and colleagues, you know, like that. If I had read this book, because I didn't, while I was going through the educational process I went through, it would have really helped me. It would have helped given me perspective. Instead, though, I did learn about the trivium while I became a medical professional during my schooling, my final schooling before I got my license. And I also learned about nonviolent communication. Those two things were really helpful in a variety of ways to really balance the terrains that I've described before. So if you could just understand what it is that you're going through and understand why you're choosing to do that, you could make things much easier by just identifying goals and measuring how well are you doing in achieving those goals. We're only making plans for Nigel. We only want what's best for him. We're only making plans for Nigel. He must be happy in his world.